Sam Kirk of being I'm an alcoholic.
Hi. I'd like to thank Clancy for asking me to come and share with my home group. It's always a privilege to talk at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, especially this one. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the very best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And I'm grateful that I'm sober today, and grateful that I'm able to come here tonight and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And in so doing, I'll stay sober one more day. This is tell you a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. When I was growing up, I was kind of a weird kid. I was the youngest of six children, and grew up in a family that was. My father wasn't an alcoholic, I don't think, but he drank a lot. And there was a lot of that craziness that you see or hear about in alcoholic homes. And I had an uncle who died of alcoholism, and he was a diabetic, and he couldn't stop drinking. And he found him dead in his car one morning. And I have a brother who's sober in the program for 6 years, and my wife is sober. I have a cousin who's sober for 8 years. Wife is a sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, her father, one of her brothers. It's really very much a family disease in my life. But in growing up, I was a weird guy. I was a terrible hypochondriac, and if you don't know what that is, that's somebody who worries about being sick all the time. And that's you're really a busy person if you do that. And I was busy all the time. And in fact, just recently I went over lung cancer. It took 2 weeks, and it was a... My fears have a way of presenting themselves in somatic responses, and I seem to spend a lot of time worrying about that from time to time. But that's you got to worry about the 7 danger signs of cancer and the 6 danger signs of renal failure, and your eyes could go at any time. I don't know if you know that or not. I was just reading about aneurysms today, and I thought, no. I was really a sick guy. A guy in this group had a similar neurosis, I suppose, and he said he got over that by getting a physical exam every year. And I thought, gee, what a simple solution. So I've tried to do that ever since. I also had a lot of problems with my religion. I'm Catholic, and growing up, everything was a sin, and at least everything that was fun was a sin, or interesting was a sin. And I heard another guy say one night that he was a Baptist, and it was the same deal in his life, and he couldn't play cards or go to movies, and dancing was even a sin. And he said that's why even today Southern Baptists never make love standing up, because they don't want to be accused of dancing. And I had a lot of problems with the Catholic Church. I won't apologize to any Southern Baptists that are here tonight. I just had a lot of problems with that, and I was a real scrupulous kid, and everything was the same, and it just, growing up was a drag. I'm glad it's done, I'll tell you that. I wouldn't want to do it again. And I had a lot of problems with sex, and I know that nobody here has ever had any problems with sex. I've had a lot of problems with sex, and I just didn't seem to understand all that. And I learned about sex in the traditional way in the late 1950s. From a 16-year-old gynecologist who practiced in the bowling alley I used to go to. And he pulled me aside one day, and he said, he explained everything to me in about 10 minutes. And maybe it was 20 minutes, that's more appropriate. And he said, what do you think of that? And I said, I can't believe that, number one. But I can't imagine people would do that to one another. And he said, yeah, they do. And I only thing I could say was, is it more fun than bowling? You know, that's the only thing I could ask. He assured me that it was, and I'll never forget the first time I had sex. I was 15 years old, and I was in the shower, and I was alone. Looking back on that, I can assure you it was the very best I've ever had, I'll tell you that. And that is the height of self-obsession right there. I really had a very difficult time with all that, and it was probably not unlike most alcoholics. And the solution for that is here in our program too, and it tells me in our book that if my sexual conduct is selfish, then I have a problem with that. And I try to use that guide today. If my conduct in that regard is selfish, then I just that's my key. I try to use that to keep myself going in a good direction. So that's the way it was before I ever took a drink. And I didn't drink in high school, and I took a drink for the first time actually just before I got out of high school. And I got drunk and threw up and had a terrible hangover for 3 days. And in the night I graduated from high school, I got drunk and drank about a half of a fifth of Early Times, which someone had given me, and I just got terribly drunk. And so for the principal of my high school, who was a priest, and he was standing behind me when I was talking about him, and I didn't know he was there, and apologized to him later. And it was just very embarrassing, and I had many embarrassing moments in my drinking, and I just never was a very good drinker. I started college right after I got out of high school, and I really shouldn't have done that because I was too immature, and and my family had been to college, and starting college was a big deal. It was just such a big deal in my head, and I just couldn't handle it, I think. And I started, and I didn't do well. I didn't think I was bright enough, and turned out I was pretty accurate on that, actually. It was kind of difficult, and I had a hard time with it, and I got on probation my first semester, and then I got off probation, and then I joined a fraternity, and that's really kind of where all that started. I was a nice guy till I joined that fraternity. Six of those fraternity brothers of mine in that same group came into this program. One is dead. One is here tonight, my sponsor, and I don't know where the rest of them are. I don't know if they're sober or not. And anyway, I'm here, and Jim is here, and that's good. We're sober and doing well. But I did a lot of drinking, and the first time I started drinking in that fraternity, I would drink maybe on Wednesdays and Fridays, which was kind of traditional. And then after a while, I started going to a local bar. I'm a local drunk. I went to Cal State LA, and there was a little pizza bar on Donna Boulevard I went to called Garfano's Pizza Parlor. Just a real kind of a spa of the San Gabriel Valley is what it was. And I would go in there in that dive, and I was very comfortable because I didn't have to be anybody, and there were no standards, and I could just be a slob, and that's really what I liked doing. I didn't want anybody to... I guess I was just very lazy at that point in my life, and I just didn't have any expectations from anybody. And I drank in there maybe once a week initially, and then by the end of my fourth year in college, I was drinking there sometimes 8-10 hours a day. And that's somewhere in there I went very quickly by social drinking. And I used to hang in there and drink and chase women, and I did that for about 10 years, and that's kind of the, and I'm just such an average alcoholic. If you could pluck somebody out of the middle of AA and say this is what a drunk is, that just fits me perfectly. Nothing, anything particularly stands out in my life. I just was an average guy from start to go, start to finish. I got out of college, and actually I was drafted in 1967 into the United States Army, and Vietnam was going on at that point in time, and I just didn't know what was going to happen. And I went in the Army, and I stopped drinking out of fear mainly, and I did very well in the Army for the first 2 months. I had stopped drinking and graduated in the top of my battalion in basic training, and I won leadership award, and all the things that I'm probably capable of doing sober manifested themselves. And then I got sent to Fort Ord, and I stayed there as a drill instructor for a while. My whole company went to Vietnam except six of us, and we're going to train soldiers. So I did that for 6 months, and I drank more there. I started drinking again, and I one time, having charge of quarters, let a whole platoon go off on pass that had been restricted, and you just don't do that, you know. I just said, be back by six, boys, and off they went, and they made it back, and I didn't get found out. And another time I had a drunken poker party in the orderly room, and I had the duty all night, and I just didn't care. When I drank, I didn't care about anything or anybody but me, and that's just the way it was, just totally, totally selfish person. I got sent to Korea after that, and that's the meter of my drinking occurred at that place and time, and I got over there, and I asked to go to the DMZ, because I was a foot soldier and an infantry, and I kind of wanted to see what it was. I thought maybe that would make me a man, I guess. And went up there, and the guy that sent me up said, you're crazy. That's not a good duty. But off I went, and I got up there, and about 3 days later, bombs started going off over the place. And I thought, well, the guy was right. I was crazy. This is a bad place to be, and
They were our own bombs, which was bad enough. I went into the DMZ in June of 1967 with John Wayne. I was one of a favorite of mine. We went in there to get our boat back and for freedom, and they'd taken the Pueblo about that time. And in September of 68, Benedict Arnold and I walked out of there. Just bad place to be. Not safe in the DMZ. You don't want to go in there at all. I almost got killed twice by my own people. I never got shot at by the North Koreans. So I had some problems with that, and I was drinking heavily, and I didn't like where I was, and some incidents occurred, and I started rationalizing the fact that I was there 20 years after the Korean War, and why should I be here dying for these people, and so on and so forth. And, you know, rationalization is one of my big traits. I'm very good at that. There's a wonderful story about rationalization, about a blacksmith who's making a horseshoe, and he's pounding out this horseshoe in Texas, and he's just all done with this thing, it's red hot, and he throws it down on the ground to let it cool off. This old cowboy had been watching him, and he walked over and bent down, picked up, and quick threw it back down on the ground again. And he looked at him, and he said, hot, wasn't it? He says, no, no. He says, it just doesn't take me long to look at a horseshoe, that's all. I had my share of those rationalizations, and I started drinking more and more, and I didn't like where I was, and I didn't like the situation, and I felt totally trapped. There wasn't any way to get out of where I was. You either died, or your time came up, and you went home. And I drank just excessively every day. After work, I'd go in the NCO club and drink, it was a bad time. And one night, I was having a hard time with it, and I went to the battalion commander, and I begged the guy to get me out of the infantry, and I was just so afraid of what was going to happen. And I was one of the few people who secretly knew that 3 million Chinese were marshaling their forces just on the other side of the DMZ. I'm afraid my alcoholism got the best of me, and it was just a humiliating experience, and I got a transfer into another outfit, and I hated myself for being a coward, and I just reacted badly. And I got drunk one night with these people at a party, and I left this party and picked up a girl that was standing against the wall and reached over the bar and took a fifth of Early Times with me and didn't pay for it and walked out and got into a taxi cab and went somewhere. And I was in and out of a blackout at that point, and when I got to her pooch, she was, the thing was locked, and I kicked it in with my combat boot and broke her door and got inside and tried to turn on the light and pull it out of the ceiling, and she asked me to take off my boots, which is her custom, and I wouldn't do that because I thought she was going to steal them. I opened that fifth of Early Times and drank some of it, and how much I don't know, but I was into a blackout and proceeded to sexually abuse that woman, and was just very fortunate I didn't kill her. That same woman who I had hurt helped me get me back together and got me into a taxi cab and sent me back to my compound that night. Next morning I woke up and I just could not remember what had happened, and I was all scratched up and hurt, and I knew I'd done something, and I could not remember what it was. I'd been in a blackout, and I just, it's a horrible feeling, and I don't want to forget that. That's why I share it when I share. And I went down that next afternoon after I kind of pieced together what had happened and found her, and she was okay, and I am very grateful for that. And I bought her 3 bars of soap so she wouldn't turn me into the MPs. Trying to do my part for American relations over in Korea. I came home shortly after that, and my drinking continued. I tried to go back to college, and I just couldn't do it. I was drinking heavily and alcoholically, and had to drop out. Then I got a job as a laborer, and I did that for 3 months, and was living at home with my parents at 24 years old, and had no direction, no life of my own, no awareness of who I was or what life was about, and just was a very lost person, right in the midst of alcoholism. I worked at this place for about 3 months, and I would drive down to Torrance every day at about 5 in the morning, and I'd work there 10 hours, and I'd go drink at a bar called the San Franciscan in Torrance on Sepulveda. And I'd drink there till maybe midnight or sometimes 2 in the morning, and I'd drive home in a blackout, and one night I didn't make it home, and I crashed a car and destroyed it, and I just remember bouncing around inside this car, and I was right near the county hospital, and I got out. The next thing I recall was standing on the side of the road looking at my car, and I was drunk, and I knew I was drunk, and I thought I'd better get sober. So being an athlete, I knew that if I did jumping jacks, I would get sober. So I was standing on the side of the freeway doing jumping jacks, and the cars were going by, and I was doing my jumping jacks, and the police came, and for some reason they didn't arrest me, and I went home, and I called an attorney, and he actually, just the reverse, a week earlier I'd been arrested for drunk driving, and the attorney had said, "Now don't drink again until we go to court," and I said, "I'll never drink again as long as I live." And a week later I crashed a car, and there I was. I had to go to court, and I got sentenced to go to 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even know about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't want to go. I knew it was bad even though I didn't know about it. And I went to Garfano's Pizza Parlor one night before, it was a Thursday evening, and I was having a few glasses of curries with the boys before I went to the meeting, and I just couldn't figure out what was going on in my life. I was 24 and my head was just empty. I just had no bearing on living at all. And I went to that meeting, and there was an old guy standing out in front of me, 65, I don't know, he's old, terribly old. Not seemed old when you were 24 anyway, and I couldn't, there was no sign or anything, and I walked up to the guy and I said in a nice, quiet tone, "Is this the, he said, "Oh, yeah, Amy." I said, "Not so loud, pal. I don't want anybody to hear that might be driving by on the street over there." And he says, "You have a seat?" And I said, "No, I don't have a seat. I just got here. How could I have a seat?" And he says, "Good, we got one for you." And I thought that was odd. And he brought me down and sat me right in the front row. And I just, geez, that pissed me off. And I just mentioned that in case you're new. You never tell them you don't have a seat. You always got a seat. You sit in the back with the rest of the new people and you judge the speaker. That's what you do. However, being wiser now, I don't judge the speaker anymore. All speakers are great, as far as I'm concerned. So I listened to an old guy speak that night. He played football against UCLA when he didn't wear a face mask and they had leather helmets, and he looked like it too, I'll tell you. And matter of fact, he sounded like it, come to think of it. And sad to say, I identified with him, and I went to talk to him afterwards, and he had done a lot of crazy things, and he suggested that I not drink for 30 days and go to meetings, and I said, "I really don't think I'm an alcoholic." And I left the meeting, and I took one of everything that was free, because I'm always big on free stuff, and I went back to the bar, and I passed out AA literature to everybody at the bar, and I was carrying the message even then, and everybody was reading their AA literature at the bar, drinking, and someone offered to buy me a drink, and I said, "No, not tonight." And I didn't have any intention of not drinking when I went back there, and I didn't drink that night. I went to that one meeting a week for about a year. I went there because I liked the people, because the people were kind to me, because they didn't make demands of me, they didn't expect me to do anything. They just knew I was sick and that I was in the right spot, and they were very loving to me, which is very important in my sobriety. I didn't know that then. I didn't have the awareness that that's why I was going there, but that's why I went back, because I really did not think I was an alcoholic. But my life got better just because I quit drinking. I went back to school, and I got my degree. And it's much easier in school, I've found, to be in the John F. Kennedy Library than in Garfano's Pizza Parlor. You get a little farther, a little faster. And I got my degree, and I waited at home for someone to come give me a job. No one came, and I had to go out and get a job, and I did. And got a little job somewhere, that was in December of 1971. And I had not had a drink for over 2 years. Nor had I had any marijuana or benzodiazepine. I just didn't, I was going to school and taking care of myself and jogging, and everything was good in my life. And I had life, it was in front of me, and I had good things going. And due to a good friend that I grew up with in high school, whose uncle worked for Elvis Presley, I started working for Elvis Presley in January of 1972. In December of 1971, I went out to celebrate the fact I was going to be working for Elvis Presley. I went to visit a brother in Oregon, and I took a girlfriend with me. And Christmas Eve of that year, we were having dinner in a restaurant, and she said, "Would you like some Matus wine?" I said, "Matus wine, you say?" She says, "Yes, it's Portuguese, you know. I used to drink Ripper wine. I think Ripper wine is made from the skin of the grape, I think, and gets you downtown in a hurry, and I like Ripper wine because it really gets you foggy in a hurry and gives you that buzzy feeling that's so It was so much of what I was seeking. And I got to have that first glass of wine, and I hadn't been to meeting for a long time, and I knew, because the seed had been planted, that I shouldn't have been drinking, but I had another glass of wine, and I didn't jump on the waitress, and I had done that one other occasion. I didn't spout my eye teeth or grow hair or anything, so I got through that evening. The next evening I drank champagne for dinner and after dinner to celebrate Christmas, and I just kept drinking. And they ran out of champagne, and I ran out to get some more champagne. And I saw that I had this opportunity in front of me to work with this, really the most successful show business guy around at the time, and it was just exciting. I worked for them part-time while I was in college, going on tours and loading airplanes and selling programs and being a kind of a gopher, and it was a lot of fun. Really, it was just really a lot of fun. Very exciting opportunity, and that would have been enough for, I guess, a normal person to just work hard and do your best. And I had started drinking again, and a few months after I started working with this show, I went on a 21-day tour of the United States in a different city every day, and my job was not glamorous, I can guarantee. It was loading equipment and luggage into airplanes and setting up stages, and it was a lot of hard work. But I was part of this show, and it was the first time in my life I had any kind of identity at all, and I felt good about that, and I liked what I did, but I was drinking, and it just was doomed for failure. And I got drunk every night on that tour, and that's 21 drunks in 21 days, and the hours were very long, and the work was very hard. And I didn't last there. I lasted a year and 7 months, and I got so angry at a man that I worked with, my immediate supervisor. I just hated the guy, and there was just terrible resentment against him, and I drank at him, and I'd had enough at one point. I quit. I couldn't get a job with any other promoters because they wouldn't touch me, and they'd quit the Elvis Presley show. It's got to be demented to begin with, so I just couldn't get back in the industry, and I just drank and tried to do the best I could, and that was in August. That was in July, August 1st of 1973. I quit, and August 26th of 1973, I had my last drink so far, and I had it up in Ventura. I was babysitting or house sitting for my brother, another brother. I met a girl jogging one morning. Asked her to a movie the next night. I picked her up drunk, very drunk. Was in a new MG. She got into the car. She wasn't very smart. We drove down to Oxnard in about 30 seconds. And I couldn't find the theater. And I opened the door, and she went into this little market to ask where we were and to find this theater, and she never came out. And I waited for her, and I waited for her, and I was a polite drunk, I'll tell you. I waited and waited, and she never came out of there. And I pulled from the front of the store into the parking lot and waited some more, and she never came out. So I thought, I was in the marina. And my best thinking at that time was that this woman has been kidnapped and that she is on a boat and she's on her way to China. And no offense, but you know what the Chinese do to women. It's just, you know, John Wayne wouldn't let that happen. So we went into the market looking for this girl, and I asked the checker if he'd seen her, and no, she's not in here. And I knew she was in there, and I looked all around. I couldn't find her. I bought a six-pack of beer on the way out, and I said, I'm going to have to call the police. He says, you can do anything you want, pal. So I called the police. I went outside, and I put a dime on the phone. I called the police, and I explained that I was at the marina, and this woman had been kidnapped, and they better get over there in a hurry. And they hung up on me is what they did. Phone went dead. I didn't know what to do, and I was drinking my beer in the phone booth, and I looked across the street, and as luck would have it, there was a police car right there. Just really, luck was with me, and I walked across the street. I bent down, and I started talking to the policeman, and I said, there is a travesty here. This woman has been kidnapped, and she's on her way to China. And the guy looked at his partner, and he looked at him, and they just drove away. And there I was, squatting in a parking lot. The next day or so, or whenever it was, I was up at the crack of noon, and I was driving down to Garfano's Pizza Parlor to have a beer with the boys, and I had a moment of clarity that our book describes, which happened to me, and the thought was very simple, and that is that if I keep drinking, I'm going to die a bum in the gutter. So that's just precisely what went through my mind. God was my higher power, was allowing me to get sober, and that was the start of it. And I went back to AA, and I did all the things that I didn't do the first time around. I went to a meeting every day, and I got a sponsor, and I mopped a lot of floors and set up tables and chairs, and I did everything everybody asked me to do. And I did that for 2.5 years in Alhambra. And I just didn't, it just wasn't the same as this group. And nor was I really doing, I was doing a lot of things I shouldn't have been doing. I was dating newcomers, I was dating married women. And I was just doing a lot of things that you don't do if you want to stay sober. I don't think they're morally bad. I don't put any connotation on anybody that does those things. They just made me very uncomfortable. And I had such lack of insight at that point, I didn't know those things were making me uncomfortable. And I came and saw Clancy one afternoon and said I was just crazy as a snake, and I was 2.5 years sober, and I was doing all the things you were supposed to be doing. Unfortunately, I was doing a lot of things I wasn't supposed to be doing as well. So I got into the action that we do here in the Pacific Group, and I was a very active and loyal member of the Pacific Group for 7 years, and went to the yard and the watches and moves, and I never missed a thing for that 7 years that I was very active here. And I recently moved away, but I was very active here, and that's what got me sober. And by sober, I mean that my life got better. And what Alcoholics Anonymous is for me is simply a simple design for living, and it says that in our book, and it's that's how I use it, and that's how I understand it, is a simple design for living. It has nothing to do with alcohol. And I heard Clancy speak one evening, and it made all the difference in my sobriety. And he said to the group I was sitting in, if you're here tonight and your problem is alcohol, you're in the wrong place. Because if you're like me, your problem isn't really alcohol. It's alcohol when we're drinking, but once we stop drinking, that isn't the problem. The problem is alcoholism. And I have the ism. And I am the problem, and I have finally realized that. I am the problem. I have always been the problem. And those 12 steps are what helped me solve my problem. So I tried to work those steps to the best of my ability, and in doing that, I've been able to stay sober here. This is still my home group, and I'm still active in Alcoholics Anonymous where I am today, but I feel good because I do the things I'm supposed to do. I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't think anybody would marry me. I was 37 years old. I was not a virgin. And 9 months and 10 seconds later, we had a baby girl, and I was sober for that, and we went to Lamaze, and I was present when my wife gave birth, and I cut the cord for that little baby girl, and I love her very much, and that was 4.5 years ago, and I have a little boy, and I was present there for him, and cut the cord, and feel very loving and fatherly to that boy as I do to my little girl, and I love my wife a great deal. I've been faithful to my wife. I've done all the things I think you're supposed to do in marriage in terms of keeping it going and making it strong. I've had difficulties in my marriage because I'm an alcoholic and I'm a very intense person. And I did not know I was an intense person when I got sober. I have very little self-awareness, and that's one of the big problems I have. And working these steps is what gives me my self-awareness. And I've had to go to marriage counseling. I've not wanted to go, but I went because I want to be married and I want to have a family and I want all the things that I think good living is all about. And good living to me is still something of an unknown. It has to kind of unfold like a carpet, like a rug. It just comes one day at a time, and I don't have all the answers, and I really don't know all that much. But I do know who I am today, and I'm an alcoholic, and that is the best gift Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Because I didn't know who I was when I got sober. And I was a very lost, confused person. I had a difficult time with working. I had never had a job. I'd been hiding in college for a long time. And for my first 4 years of sobriety, I had crummy little jobs. And I finally had some insight to that recently. I had crummy little jobs because I was a crummy little guy. It was that simple. I got a job in the business I'm in today after 4 years of sobriety, and a funny thing happened. I listened to my boss. He said, do it this way. And I didn't say, oh, you mean this way. I did it the way he told me to do it. And I didn't read between the lines. I just read the black print. And I learned from him. And that's an amazing thing. I've never been willing to learn before. But by being sober, I was willing to listen. And I stayed with him for a year, and I went with another company for 3 years, and then I went for a short time with someone else, and that spurred me into going into business for myself. And in 1981, I did that, and I worked hard and used the principles that I've learned right here in this group and the principles in Alcoholics Anonymous that are taught in this group, that we see in action in this group. And if I was out on the road somewhere at 4:30, I went back to my office. I didn't go home. I did all the good things that I was learned here by going to the yard and going to watches and moves and all that. Everything I learned there, I practice in my business. And that's how it's gone. And that went very, very well for 5 years. And I grew and had several offices and people working for me. And at one meeting, we had a staff meeting one day, and I had 20 people sitting there. And I was standing there looking at them, and I thought, I don't feel comfortable with this. And I really became too successful, I guess, and it went to my head. And I had a real difficult time with it. Because I'm a loser. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a loser. As big a loser as you can be. I had nothing going for me. And I really didn't know how to handle all that. And I didn't handle it very well. And I made some bad decisions. And I got some of my people angry at me. And justifiably so. And five of the six people who were so key to me left about a year ago. And it was a very difficult, trying time for me. Because I had a lot of overhead and a lot of responsibility, and I just thought everything was going to go to hell. But I employed what I have learned right here. I didn't quit. I talked to people. I went to meetings, and I just went to work every day. One of the best ethics Clancy taught me was do what's in front of you, and do it to the best of your ability each day, one day at a time. And that's what I did. And today, things are okay. It's gone. I haven't lost my business. I haven't gone bankrupt. And none of that happened because I didn't quit. And if I hadn't come here, and if I didn't have these 12 steps and this simple design for living to fall back on, I would be a loser again. And I'd be out whining and complaining that life was just a bitch and I never got a break. And that isn't true. Life takes a lot of work, and I learned that here. I moved out to Claremont almost 2 years ago to buy a home, and I'm active in that group out there, and I was secretary of the meeting out in Upland, and I just recently started with another person. I'm co-sponsor of an Alateen meeting out there. I want to get a jump on my children. And that's been a real good experience for me. It just gives me a little more insight about me. And same thing with sponsoring people. I sponsored a lot of people when I was active in this group, a number of people, I should say, and the best thing about that was that, number one, I got to love them, and I found out about myself. Because I can see in them what's wrong with me, but I can't see it in me by looking at me. Because I am incapable of being objective about Tom. I can be objective about you, and in so doing, I can see things in myself, kind of like a mirror reflection. And then I can try to change or go in a more positive direction. And that's how it's all... It's all gone well. I had a real difficult time with this work situation, and the best thing about all that is that I realized I made mistakes. It kind of grounded me in reality, really. It was a good thing in some ways, because it made me utilize AA. It made me realize I'm not perfect, and that everything isn't going to be just handed to me in my life. I really had to work hard on that whole situation, and I'm just so grateful I had Alcoholics Anonymous to fall on, to lean against, to use. I don't know what the future holds, and I have geared my entire talk to end at 9:15. I have nothing else to say. I'm very pleased I'm sober. God has been very good to me, my higher power, as I understand him. And this one guy said to me one evening, he says, Tom, it's not important that you know who God is as long as you know it's not you. And that's the very best thing I've learned about that. And that's about as much as I know about it. I just try to do the best I can one day at a time. And I don't drink, and I don't use drugs, and I don't smoke marijuana. And I don't try to impress people anymore. I just try to understand who I am. And who I am is very simple. I'm Tom Kirkaboo. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a father. I'm a sponsor. I'm a son. I'm a husband. And I'm a friend. And before I got sober, I didn't know that that's all there is. Thanks very much.